Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
The Steve Austin Show Unleashed is sponsored in part this week by DDP Yoga. As you guys have heard on the show before, I love to talk about DDP Yoga and share all of the inspiring stories of people, regular people like you and me, who have changed their lives through DDP Yoga. Here's yet another incredible story about a man named John Kaiser. Turns out when John was 22 years old, he was hit by a drunk driver. And since then, John has consistently tried to manage with the steady state of pain he was in. He couldn't sit, stand, or even lie down without being in constant discomfort. John's had over 200 physical therapy sessions. His three lower discs were completely herniated. He lost control of his arm and his right leg. It literally took him 10 minutes to put on his shoes. But like many others, John discovered the inspirational videos on YouTube of people in difficult physical situations making tremendous changes using DDP Yoga. Within a couple of weeks of doing the program, John got stronger. John was getting his life back. 5 to 6 months into doing DDP Yoga, John took an 11-hour business trip in his car from New York to Indiana, and it was pain-free. Weight loss isn't the only thing that DDP Yoga can help. It can help manage pain. It can help you do things that you didn't think you could do again. So don't wait. Go to ddpyoga.com/Steve Austin and check out all the great deals DDP has for listeners of the Steve Austin Show Unleashed. There's also the DDP Yoga Now app for working out on the go, available on iOS and Android. Again, go to ddpyoga.com/Austin and be on your way to not only changing your life, but owning your life. Oh, hell yeah.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're going to take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
All right, everybody, welcome to Steve Austin Show. I'm coming to you from the main streets of Los Angeles, California today, over here at 317 Gimmick Street, sitting at a table in the middle of a living room in my Austin 316 chair. I got the ceiling fan spinning around like a rotisserie chicken on the low setting so you don't hear it spinning around like a rotisserie chicken. I got this table parked up on a rug so my voice doesn't bounce too much. How's it doing? I need some more rugs up in this motherfucker. Anyway, the front door is open. I've got the screen door closed. It's on lock. Make sure nobody busts in here. But if they do, I've got a big ass can of whoop ass and a baseball bat waiting behind the door for their ass. I'm sitting here, and my new little buddy, Callie, my black Labrador Retriever, is laying right beside me, sleeping like a baby. This little son of a bitch. My wife, Kristen, got up early this morning to take the dogs to the vet. She figured Callie had an ear infection, and she's getting a checkup on Moolah, who needed some shots, rabies shots, etc. So anyway, she took him to the vet. I stayed back to cook breakfast and get ready to do the open for this podcast. My guest today is Raven of the Raven Effect, Scott Levy, my old travel partner. And she got back from the vet, and goddamn, I came out of the shower, just got finished shaving and everything so I could go down to the Red Cross and give a pint of blood this afternoon. I'm getting ready to get geared up for that. And I got a shower, and goddamn it, this little dog, Callie, loves the swimming pool. She gets in there and she'll just get into the hot tub and she'll just sit. And it's about, well, the water comes right up to the bottom of her jaw. And she just sits there looking out like a little bitty Loch Ness monster. And it's cute as hell. But back in the day, she's only 7.5 months old, so she's still a pup. But back in the day when she would get in the hot tub, she didn't know any better. She'd just come running through the house like a banshee, man, just throwing water everywhere. Well, we broke her of that. So now when she goes and gets in the swimming pool, it's cool. But now she knows that she cannot come inside until I walk out there on the cement and dry her off with a towel. So anyway, I just come out of shower with my own towel and was getting ready to come over here and do this podcast. And there she is sitting in the swimming pool. And my wife says, your dog just got in the swimming pool again. So I went out there and dried her ass off. I brought her over here next door to me. And she loves coming over here with me. Every time I come over here and work out, I've got to bring a tennis ball because there's a brick wall between houses. And so I throw the ball against the wall, and goddamn, that dog will just fetch it incessantly until I just quit or tire out or whatever. I can barely get a workout in. And when I come over here, every single time, she likes to come over here and hang out because it's like that's our thing to do. Helicopter passing overhead. Can you hear that? I'm so sick of these goddamn helicopters. I'm trying to tell you how cute my Labrador puppy is over here sleeping on my right-hand side over here on the rug, and his helicopter comes buzzing overhead. Anyway, me and this dog, we're starting to get thick as thieves. And like I was telling you, I'm trying to get another buddy, just like I had Hershey the Wonder Dog for all those years. And me and that dog were inseparable. And man, wherever I went, Hershey had to go. And I've tried to take that up with Mula. Mula's more of a house dog. But Callie's kind of a buddy dog so far. I'm hoping that she likes to hang out with me. And you know how some dogs are, man. They're just right there by your side. And then others just like chill at the house. That's Mula. So I'm hoping that Callie turns out to be like the greatest dog in the world, Hershey the Wonder Dog, who's no longer with me. Anyway, god damn, I tell you what, the helicopter just buzzed overhead. And I told you guys last week, you know, a while back we went to the Tamarack Lodge in Mammoth Lakes, California. It was an absolutely beautiful place. And I'm already thinking about heading back to Nevada from that other trip. My brother-in-law is back from his hunting adventures, and I got a chance to use his house again to get back out there and look around and just get outside of Los Angeles. Man, this fucking concrete jungle is really chapping my ass. I can deal with it for, you know, a long time, but without the Broken Skull Ranch to go to down there in South Texas is really kind of put me in a crunch and left a void because I don't have a place to just escape to and get away. And I'm looking forward to November and December because I'm still trying to plan that out. Because normally, man, every year, and it's just right around the corner, so that's why I'm talking about it, every year we headed down to South Texas and we stayed for 2.5 months, November all the way through about the first 7 to 10 days of January. We see my folks down there for Thanksgiving. We do Christmas together. But now that I don't own that ranch, I know my mom was talking about doing Thanksgiving, so we're going to do that. Maybe Christmas. No, I don't think we're going to do Christmas. I've got a hunt booked down there at a ranch 25 miles from the Broken Skull, and I'm going to hunt with those folks for about a week, and then I'm going to go to the Broken Skull Ranch. And those owners, the new owners, have invited me to hunt with them for a couple of days, and I'm not really going to hunt. I'm just going to sit in a deer stand and film with a video camera, help them see the deer that they're looking for, and just look around. I just want to ride around on a place on a Kawasaki mule. They brought Kawasaki mules just like I use. And so they're cruising around out there, and they conveyed the two Broncos with the place. They got the Broncos, so it'll be damn near like, it'll be kind of like being a homecoming. I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of shape that they've kept the ranch in ever since I've been gone. Because, man, me, my wife, and Ted Fowler, 361, maintain that place like a state park. Teddy was in charge of the water system from the Big Pila, the main water system, down to the 3,000-gallon Pilas. Teddy had all that shit figured out. Anytime those owners call me and ask me a question like that, I say, man, you're going to have to call my buddy Ted. He's the one to handle that. There was so much of that damn ranch that he handled. And, you know, I let Ted do that because, man, as soon as Ted sets his mind to do something, he might not know nothing about it, but he'll get on YouTube and he'll start researching all these, like as far as a water well goes, like contact points, different parts of the well, ball valves, all kinds of shit, float valves. And that motherfucker starts reading about it, and fuck, you think he was trained out of college for it. So Ted handled a lot of that shit. I'm looking forward to getting back down there and just kind of kicking around and looking at the place. And I've been wanting to go back ever since I put that place up for sale. I've been looking for one last arrowhead that I can say came from the Broken Skull Ranch in South Texas. So I want to get out there between hunts and me just videoing and just look around for arrowheads and find a couple just for keepsakes, just for memory, and look forward to seeing what they did with the place. Hopefully they've improved it or maintained it the way Ted, my wife, and I did. Looking forward to seeing some big-ass deer because, goddamn, we grew some big-ass deer down there, man. There's going to be some good ones on foot. And then before I get to Texas, though, I have my first mule deer hunt booked in Nevada. I'm hunting with my brother-in-law, who I just spoke of earlier. We're looking to go down and stay with him and visit with him. But November 1 through 5, I'll be taking part in my first mule deer hunt. I don't give a shit if I get anything or not. I just want to get out there in the Sierra Nevadas. I've heard so much. I've been a little bit out there. But I've never been on a mule deer hunt. It's a whole different animal, ball of wax. It's a deer, but the mule deer, the behavior, the whole thing is different than the South Texas white-tailed deer, and just a whole different environment. Because, man, when you look in South Texas, you're talking about brush country. You're talking about thick-ass brush, limited range on shots. Certain you can air one out on a long Sendero or something like that. But, you know, when you're talking about that big country out there in Nevada, you know, you're talking, you know, a 300 to 500-yard shot. It can happen all day long. I mean, that's the kind of shots folks are taking, and longer than that, I might add. But I'm not going to take any kind of crazy shots. I might actually even do some muzzle loader with my brother-in-law. I'm going to take my 7 mag on this hunt. I think my 300 Win Mag is a little overkill. I'm going to go 7 mag. And if you've been following the podcast for a while, you know when I'm in South Texas, I'm a 308 guy. So was Teddy. We just love a 308. At the distances we're shooting at, whether it's pigs, hogs, coyotes, whatever, that caliber is magnificent. But out there in that bigger country, with a little bit, I want to carry and shoot a little bit flatter. And the 308 will certainly shoot out to the range that I'm going to be shooting at. But I just think that 7 mag is a better choice. Going to take that. And goddamn, I'm looking forward to it as this plane flies overhead. And it's another reason why I can't wait to get the fuck out of Los Angeles, get rid of all this noise. But anyway, hey, man, it's enough of me rambling. I'm just sitting here shooting the shit. Let me tell you something. I read every damn email that comes in, questions at steveaustinshow.com. Listen to the close of this podcast. I'm asking you guys to send me your emails, questions, comments, suggestions, something you want me to talk about or cover. Sometimes I don't, you know, I like to talk to people, but sometimes I don't like to talk to people. But if you give me something that you want to hear about, I can give you my 411 on it. So please keep your questions, comments, suggestions, or topics that you want me to cover or someone you want me to podcast with and discuss current events on. Send them to me, man. I'm dying for it. Here's an email from Elliot from West Virginia. Dig this story. Hey, Steve, love the podcast. The story about your experience while eating a tamarack reminded me of a similar thing that happened to me and my wife. We had went for an afternoon matinee movie once and was excited to see we were the only ones in the theater. I love having a near-empty theater as I inevitably have some obnoxious popcorn muncher or talker sit close to me when there's not too many empty seats. As we sit there, the only two in the theater and almost time for the previews, these two dudes walked in, both carrying the biggest popcorn bucket sold. As they turn to see where they're going to sit, I see they look at us, and I then get the feeling, surely these popcorn-eating sons of bitches aren't going to sit by us with the whole damn theater to choose from. Anyway, they start walking up the walkway on our side. Again, I'm thinking to myself, surely not. Oh, yeah, these two dumbasses walk right up past our row, then turn around and walk over and sit directly behind us. The whole damn theater's empty, and I'm thinking, you got to be fucking kidding me. Anyway, we sit there a couple minutes till I'm almost fuming. I then stand up and tell a wife, this is ridiculous. Come on, we're moving over to the other side of the theater. We move over, and nothing else is said, and we enjoy the movie. But I can't help but remember they had the whole fucking theater to choose from, could sit anywhere but around our two seats, and they sit directly behind us with a huge-ass buckets of popcorn. I laugh at it now, but was thoroughly pissed at the time. Elliot in West Virginia. God damn it, man. You ain't shitting, man. It's always like that. Like me and my wife, we're the only two in that restaurant, and I'm thinking, ain't no way. Ain't no way these motherfuckers are going to sit by us, and surely they did. And then that dude had to have that cologne on. Man, you fucking kidding me? Dude, I'll say it once, I'll say it again. Whether you're a guy or girl, lighten the fuck up on the cologne and perfume. Believe me, little dab, a little spray will do you. Dude, I feel for you over in that theater. I've had that happen before too, man. I just think some people are lonely. And when he says he was hot about it, it is just frustrating. You hear these people these days, everybody's going crazy about everything. Goddamn, from, I don't know, everybody's skin is so thin these days. So I understand your frustration. It's not something you just want to fight over, but it's just like, you just want to turn around, you think, motherfucker, really? We're the only motherfuckers. There's 50 to 100 seats here, and you want to sit right the fuck behind us? It don't make sense. But that's just the way it goes sometimes. It's frustrating. Hey, one more question or comment before I get into the podcast with Raven, Scott Levy of The Raven Effect on the Jericho Network at Podcast One. One more question a guy wrote in to me. Again, I'm not a diet expert. I want to get off this keto diet for a little bit, but please keep sending me your questions because I enjoy answering them. I want to talk about some other diet systems here in the future. Here's a guy, because I want to bottom line this one more time to anybody out there that's trying to consider losing weight, and you really do want to. Guy says, hey, Mr. Austin, first of all, I'm a big fan. I want to say thank you for doing that podcast with Dave Palumbo. For a guy that's trying to lose some weight, the knowledge is so valuable, I listened to it twice. I'm about to start the journey. In your mind, what is the biggest tip of the diet? Any answer is much appreciated. Also, love the Broker's Gold Challenge on a podcast that has to win an award someday. Thanks, James. Hey, James, here's an answer. And first of all, before you start the keto diet, consider, you know, just regular diets as well, just as far as dropping some carbs down and not going zero carb or less than 20 grams of carbs. So consider your options before you decide, hey, let me go keto. I had tried every diet in the book, and I decided to try keto, and it worked for me. So I just want to, you know, make sure that you explore your options before you choose the diet. But if you chose keto, here's my advice on the diet. I wrote James back. I try to answer as many emails as I can. I said, James, glad you like the podcast. Biggest tips are, this is what I wrote to him, 4 tips. Number 1, track all of your food. I use an app called Chronometer. I can't remember if it's a free app or I paid $1.99 for it. Chronometer is so goddamn easy to use. I mean, I tried MyFitnessPal. I couldn't understand it. If you use it and it works for you, more power to you. Chronometer was simple as fuck. And the Chronometer app was recommended to me by Tyler Cartwright of KetoGains.com. Man, you talk about a smart, knowledgeable dude. This guy was a wealth of information when I first started exploring the ketogenic diet. And I'd love to talk to Tyler on the podcast and talk straight up standard keto, because I think that's what he practices. And he's had tremendous success with it. I use modified keto. He does standard. But, you know, he's a wealth of information. He's the guy that recommended Chronometer to me. And I just love it as far as tracking my food. So anyway, back to the answer. Track all of your food. I use an app called Chronometer. And before I found that app, I just wrote everything down in a notebook because I didn't know any better. I couldn't figure out MyFitnessPal. This is before Tyler turned me on to Chronometer. I would just write down it, dude, in just a straight up notebook. And I would get on Calorie King and I'd look up all my measurements. Right now, if you show me a piece of food, I can tell you how many carbohydrates, proteins, grams of fat, and calories that motherfucker is. That's how accurate I am now. I still weigh my food. But before I found that scientific app, I wrote everything down in a notebook. 2, be consistent with diet and all workouts. Hey, man, if you're going to embark on this journey, you have to stay straight up consistent and do it every single day with regard to your diet. No cheats, no nothing. Dave Palumbo worked in a cheap meal with me several weeks. It might have been 2 months into the program before I got a cheat meal, because we had to getting on a diet and starting the fat burning process. It's kind of like being in the woods and starting a fire. Sometimes that fire doesn't catch and it starts smoldering, smoldering, smoldering. Finally, it starts catching, like the metabolism starts spinning up. And so then you're just rocking and rolling and just everything's dropping off. But you don't get a cheat day initially. So be consistent with the diet. Put in the work when it comes to your workouts. Whether you're working out 3 times a week, 4 times a week, 6 times a week, I don't give a shit. Whether your cardio is every day, steady state, high intensity, I don't care. Whatever your program is, you must be consistent with your diet and all of your workouts. 3, take a photo of yourself in the mirror once a week for your records and to note progress. The scale does not always tell the truth of what is going on. So sometimes when that scale, when that needle's not moving or that digit is not going down, hey man, sometimes it's a change in body composition. You might start looking better and still weighing the same. Well, if you're still weighing the same, but you're looking better, shit's happening, and good shit. So make sure that you take those photos. And that's one of the things where I was, you know, being held accountable by Dave. He's been bodybuilding or in the sport for, geez, I guess probably close to 30, 40 years. And he has a very good eye. And you don't have to be a bodybuilder with 30 years experience to notice a difference in the pictures. So try to use, I would always try to take the picture in the same mirror in the same light all the time. If you're traveling, don't make a shit. Just make sure you take your weekly picture, because that way you can look back and say, okay, scale ain't moving, I look the same. Or the scale is moving, I'm looking better. It's all about tracking your progress. 4, be patient. Look for results weekly or biweekly or even monthly. Do not look for results daily or overnight. That never happens, and you will end up setting yourself up for failure. That's about it. Good luck, Steve. P.S. Set a realistic short-term and long-term goal with a date. So let me get back to 4. There's been times, you know, I was caught up in a diet, and man, I have a hell of a weightlifting session over here at the gym. I do my cardio, and I'm thinking, man, I got to go look at myself in the mirror. Almost expecting there to be a visual loss in body fat from one workout because I thought I had such a good workout. Nah, big mistake, real dumb. You can go look at yourself, but don't look for short-term results on a daily, nightly, two-day. You might get to the point where you're seeing those results come then, but don't look at that or you're setting yourself up for failure. Let me let this motherfucking helicopter pass by. Motherfucker. I'm NPR radio. This is not. So anyway, dude, be patient. It's going to take you a long ass time to get down where you want to go, depending on how much weight you have to lose. And for me, man, sometimes, you know, when we first started, it was slow. And then it got to be sometimes a pound, 1.2, 2 pounds a week. That was exciting. And then it would stagnate. I might stay the same weight for a couple of weeks. And then he'd kick back in. So I was very, very patient. Now, me being by myself, I would have modified that. I would have started making changes to my diet plan. So be patient. And let me add in another 5. If you do change your diet, if you are working, you know, doing this for yourself, with yourself, make very gradual changes and change, you know, one factor. Dave would only change, like, he would only mess with fats, because really that's all we had to mess with. Well, no, we took out protein in the beginning, but it'd be like 1 ounce of protein a meal or this many grams of fat. I mean, minor changes, one at a time. So make very, very small increment changes if you decide to make changes. And then that last one, like I said, set a realistic short-term and long-term goal with a date. I did, and it helped me see the writing on the wall and helped me stay true to what I was trying to do to help me achieve that goal. Anyway, let me wrap this thing up.
I've got Scott Levy, the Raven, on the podcast. Part two of our conversation, Shooting the Breeze at 317 Gimmick Street. Send me your questions, comments, and suggestions to questions at steveaustinshow.com. Here we go.
Hi there. My name is Susie Schuster.
And I'm Rich Eisen.
We're teaming up once again in the studio with our new podcast, Not Just Sports, with Susie Schuster and Rich Eisen.
So we're sportscasters and we're parents, so we're just going to be hanging out, talking sports and other stuff.
And I will try to educate you on all things in the NFL, because
Thank
of course
you.
Behind every great man is a greater woman.
That's correct.
There you go.
Join us every Wednesday exclusively on Podcast One Sports.
Subscribe today if you know it's good for you on Apple Podcasts or at podcastone.com, or download it on the new Podcast One app.
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
All right, I'm sitting here at 317 Gimmick Street. No agenda on hand. Sitting here talking about anything. Scott Levy. Hey, how do you pronounce your last name? I said Levy on
no,
the first
it's Levy.
Episode.
Levy.
Yeah. Sorry about that. You want me to have it cleaned up by
I don't
post?
Care. No, I don't care.
Well, I always call you Scotty.
Yeah. I remember you used to leave me voicemails. You'd go, the Raven, call, the Raven. And you would do that for like 4 or 5 minutes until you got bored of doing it. And you would just entertain yourself. You'd be cracking up like after every third call.
But then you would return them. It got to be kind of ridiculous. Then we lost touch with each other for a long time.
Yeah.
We got back in touch, and now you're over here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
It's
you know
good
what?
To see you.
Thank you, man. It's great to see you. What it was is I'm not a big phone person. I'm like in person, I'll chew your ear off. But at home, once I'm away from the business or people, I'm just a hermit. You know, I want to sit on my couch with my dog and watch TV and just not be bothered. And so I don't really keep in touch with very many people. You know, like me and Hurricane tweet each other, text each other maybe every 4 or 5 months, you know.
He'll send me a GIF or whatever you call it, like some crazy bump in Japan or something like that. Just here or there. Do you keep up with anybody? Because I got like a few guys that I'll call on a random basis, but going back to your point, man, like a lot of people leave me voice messages, not a lot, but whoever does leave me a voice message. And dude, they're like, finally I'll see them. Like, dude, we got heat or what?
Right.
I know, man. I'm sorry. Everybody hates me because I never return text messages. I never return phone calls and sometimes an email. But I got a couple guys I still talk with, but dude, I haven't forgotten anybody. I'm just not very, I'm not a very big phone guy either.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like you have your significant other, you know, like I got married, but we got divorced, to save the friendship, so we're best friends. It's the best relationship I've ever been in, but if I got something to tell somebody, I'll tell her. You know, I don't want to tell anybody. Like, you know, back in the day when you're younger, you want to tell everybody, you know, you do something interesting or, you know, war story, whatever. Like, I want to tell her. I don't really care about anybody else. I'll tell my dog. My dog likes to listen, you know, but... I don't have any need to or desire to. And, you know, so maybe when I die, I'm not going to have a whole lot of people at the funeral because I didn't keep in touch with anybody, but I'm going to be dead. I'm not going to know anyway.
Have you ever, I don't want to start talking about death, but I'm going to be cremated.
Are you?
Yeah. And the reason I said is because I figured like this, hopefully I'm going to live another 20 years. And so there'd be valuable real estate that I would be taking up by just laying in the ground. So if you just burn me, scatter my ashes, well, that'll be pollution. So
right.
Maybe I need to rethink this.
I'm going to leave my organs. Like,
I'm an organ donor too.
Yeah. Well, I don't have a piano, but if I get one, but no, I'm going to be, I think everybody should be an organ donor.
Yeah, you should.
You know, so
yeah, but I'm thinking, man, it's like I don't know who's gonna want this liver. it's like we could put Austin's liver in you, but we think you'll be worse off.
Remember, DDP used to be, I'm 45, I look 35, and I work like I'm 25. Well, I used to be, I'm 45, I look like I'm 65, and my internal organs are like 95.
We were talking about, who were we talking about? I can't remember what we were talking about.
Here, I'll buy you some time.
Buy me some more time.
All right, one more time.
All right. Did I tell you the time I was working with Lawler and he's trying to call high spots before we even locked up?
No.
I've told the story too many times on the podcast. But anyway, it's the first time I was working with Lawler. And he's wanted to book the match. Monday, Memphis. Tuesday, Louisville. Wednesday, in Evansville. And believe me.
Let me just say real quick. best worker I've ever seen in history of business. When he was back in the day in Memphis, I don't think there's ever been anybody better.
Dude, I'm a huge fan as well. He's one of the best ever.
Yeah.
And it was very economical. And like I was telling someone the other day, Lawler was more of a brawler than he was a scientific wrestler.
Sure.
He was a stand-up guy.
But that's how you drew money back then, because it was a fight. It was supposed to be a fight.
But I'm in a ring working with him, and he booked the territory. So I guess he wanted to beat the new guy coming in territory. I don't know.
Why wouldn't he?
I was jacked up. I looked the part, but just as soon as the bell rang, forget about it. Right. Anyway, so we're working. We're pacing around the ring in a clockwise direction, whatever happened. And there's Lawler going into ventriloquist mode. All right, you grab a headlock, tackle, drop down, you tackle, right. Drop down, hip toss spot. And go, I don't hear very well.
Right.
What?
And your nerves are probably like...
Nerves. Dude, I'm working with the king.
Yeah.
And so anyway, he calls the high spot three times, and I'm like, huh? And fuck, it was dude in the front row was going, he said tackle, drop down, hip toss, Jay Brown. But I'll never forget working with Lawler. And I always wanted to work with Lawler when I was accomplished, when I was really good.
Right.
So I would have loved to have feuded with him when Austin was at his peak and Lawler was at his peak.
That's what I would have loved to do that. I mean... You know, it's a shame. Like when I was in WWE and they had me, we were in Memphis and I was working with Lawler and I sold Vince on this idea right before they terminated me. I sold him on this idea, the seven deadly sins. It was the greatest storyline I ever wrote, right? And so Vince is like, oh my God, that's great. I want you to be on the booking committee. And I'm like, I don't want to be in the booking committee. I want to wrestle. I want to do this. So he's like, all right. He goes, I want you to quit, because I was commentating on Heat. He goes, I want you to quit Heat. I want you to do a count out with Lawler. I'm like, no, you can't have me do a count out with Lawler in Memphis. I gotta do the job. He's like, no. And now I look back, maybe it was partial rib, but so he goes, and he had to leave the building. So I gotta tell Briscoe that Vince doesn't want me to do the job, right? So I guess I hear that it ends up in Lawler's book that I wouldn't do the job for him, but the funny thing is I'm like, I'll go on record anywhere and say he's the best worker I've ever seen. I mean, far and away, but I'm like, what a way, like, if you're for your hero, you know what I mean?
Yeah, to remember you, yeah, especially in his book.
Yeah, but it was pretty cool, though, is he goes, I didn't write half the book anyway, so because I don't care.
What did you like about Lawler's work?
Well, let me give you some of the odd things first. He took crazy bumps. Like, he took fearless bumps. Like, when Joe LeDuc threw him onto the wooden table. Yeah, onto the table. So, he was ballsy. I mean, not that that's a big skill, but...
But let me interject. He didn't take crazy bumps all the time, only in big angles. He worked very safe.
That's what I'm getting at is... So for people who think, you know, he just was, you know, just a... Now, all they see is he's a drop kick, you know, and whatever... You know, they don't. You'll never get it. If you didn't watch Lawler before he went to WWE, you'll never get him. But he was so, he could talk people into the seats, babyface or heel. He was so believable in his work. He was economical. He was creative. He never had the same comeback twice, you know, which we all did the same comeback because the people wanted it, you know, because you build a rapport and you want to have your signature moves. But he didn't, other than he had the fist drop, which was his signature finish.
Well, that and pulling a strap.
And pulled a strap, yeah. So, but then once he pulled the strap, it was all varied, which I really respect because it changes the comeback, but yet he still has the signature beginning of it and the signature end to it. And everything he did, like, although the first time I'm working with him, and like, when you punch him, he slaps you on the side of your belly to make a pop, and he slapped me and I sold it. It's like, what are you doing? Like, I'm an idiot. But he's just everything he did. Like, this is what I was going to say. So this is how clever he was. He's working Razor Ramon. I told the story a bunch of times, but never here. So he's working Razor Ramon. Razor Ramon shoots the toothpick at him. Lawler goes down like he's been shot. The camera shoots over. Lawler's holding the toothpick in his eye. Like, he'd been like, the toothpick went right in his eye. He's selling it like nobody's business. And I was like, wow. Instead of having your regular old match with, you know, like, because, you know, it's going to be a 5-minute regular TV match.
Yeah.
He just made this into something totally cool and unique. I mean, it's just, that's the cleverness. You know, I mean, it's like when you watched matches back in the day, they'd have squash matches all the time. And there was nothing worse than watching certain guys have squash matches because they were so boring. But then you watch Jake the Snake and he made a squash match look like a main event, you know, And that's how the King was.
But you had to be, we're both huge Jerry Lawler fans, and I talk about it on podcasts so much, I sound like an idiot. People say, hey, he's blowing smoke up Lawler's ass again. I just love the guy's work. I love his promos. I love everything. He had a great career, and it was great to watch.
And he was so excited. When he made that comeback, I still get goosebumps when I watch
just
it.
Just the way he sold, though. I mean, you know, he was like, dude, that was theater.
You know what he would do? I don't know if you ever noticed this. When he would pull the strap down, he'd go up on his tippy toes and push his chest out, which just all of a sudden he got bigger.
Yeah.
And you know.
But it was also posture too. It was like, hey, motherfucker, you know,
right.
Shit's on.
But to the audience, you don't see those little things. But right. All of a sudden, he just got bigger. You know, like it's just little things like that.
So if you're a big Lawler fan, you got to be a huge Jake fan. Because when you say economic as a worker to Lawler, exact same for Jake. Now, different. I wouldn't say a different type of worker, but their body language was different.
Jake's probably my second favorite worker.
Okay, but I mean, he's one of my favorites as well. But when you say economical, everything Jake did was for a reason. And when I say economical, I mean it's a compliment.
Yeah.
Everything he did meant something. He's always working for that DDT because that's how he's going to finish somebody. That guy was phenomenal, and he was a great promo. It's always sometimes when you hear these people talk about, oh, yeah, the five greatest promos, blah, blah, blah. Dude, Jake's one of the best promos. Jake. Lawler's one of the best promos. There's two on your top three or five list right there.
You know, I'm in at number four.
Yeah, and I'm going to take the odd spot at five. I want to be in the top 10. I want to be 7 or 9. What did you like about Jake's work?
Oh, let me just say one thing. Remember when a Booker T would go, he'd go, I'm one of the four. I'm one of the top five workers in the business. And Disco would go, that means you're number five. And he goes, no, I'm in the top five. He goes, well, if you're number four, you'd be in the top four workers.
But here's the thing. And me and Booker used to laugh about this when we both got up in WWF because we always got along real good. I remember when he came down to WCW, you know, him and Steve Ray, they were a good tag team.
Yeah, yeah.
Great look. And then Booker T went on with his singles run, which is great. But when he came down, he was talking, yeah, man, I'm one of the top five workers in the world. Yeah. And it was such bullshit.
Yeah.
And he had actually, the whole locker room was stirred up because, like, man, what the fuck's this guy talk about? Right. How can he be the top five?
Yeah.
He was just arbitrarily making up this stat. And the way you know, because Booker's a good talker.
He's a great talker.
But just the way he was saying it, like, the boys thought it was a shoot. And, like, everybody was, like, kind of defending himself.
Right.
And, like, it was one of the greatest ribs in the history of my time there.
And probably one of the baddest guys in the locker room that doesn't act like he's a badass. You know what I mean? Like, as a shoot.
Oh, no. As a street fighter. And the dude, he didn't play football. He played in a band in high school.
Yeah, he was the band lead, the band major.
Yeah, he was the baddest band major ever.
Ever.
Whatever you call him. Band major, band leader. But anyway, he was a badass.
Yeah, exactly.
Go back to Jake's work.
Yeah, here's the funny thing is for years, Jake was my favorite worker of all time, and now I'm in a Lawler phase. But I'm sure it'll go back to Jake. Like, but it'll always be those two are my favorite workers because they both talked people into the seats. They made you believe in what they said. They made you – they could have a crappy match, which they didn't. I mean, I don't think they could have a crappy match, but – you could have, like Dusty was able. Like, Dusty could have the worst match, but then next week on TV, he'd talk you right back into the seats. Like, and you'd forget that he had a bad match. And that's the arc or the, like, look at the Sheik. I mean, the Sheik, well, he didn't even talk, but he could have these, you know, matches where they'd have a 5 minute count out, yet they'd come back the next and sell the place out again. I mean, there's a certain skill and being able to make people want to pay to see you get your ass kicked or to see you kick their ass. And both of them have it in spades.
Man, to me, growing up a huge Jake the Snake fan, and then it was when Undertaker really started running roughshod in WWF. And God dang, man, just to segue on him for a second. Man, when they first plucked him out of WCW, because he came down to Dallas, I wrestled a couple times with him. I couldn't hear the high spots. He just had to smoke me
right.
And beat me on TV. And I was horrible. And he goes through WCW, and he's part of the Twin Towers or
whatever
they were, him and Spivey. And what an awesome look. And even when he was the Punisher or Mean Mark, all that stuff, you just knew. I mean, just dude, he was so big and intimidating. Like, dude, this guy's got star written all over him. I don't know if he's going to put the pieces together, but he's got star written all over him. Sure enough, here he goes up to WWF, and they put that Undertaker gimmick on him. And There is nobody that could have pulled off that gimmick like Mark did.
No.
Nobody.
I've always said that if he was 6 inches shorter, he would have probably been the Ric Flair of the 1990s. You know what I mean? Like the perennial world champion, winning the belt, losing the belt. But because he was so big, they had to put him in a creature feature match for the longest time, and he couldn't display how good a worker he really was.
Yeah, because as the biggest guy in the territory, you can't wrestle everybody scientifically.
Right.
It just doesn't make sense.
But if he would have been 6'3 instead of 6'10, imagine the matches he would have had then.
Speculation. Back to what really happened, though. So Vince puts the Undertaker gimmick on him. Man, I remember when he made his debut. I've talked about this podcast. I'll get to the point I was trying to make because we're talking about Jake the Snake Roberts. All of a sudden, he makes his debut at Survivor Series, whatever it was. I think he drops Snook on his dome. Dude, he was so scary.
Yeah.
I mean, for a shoot.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, I knew the guy. I wrestled him a couple times.
Right.
And we weren't tight at all. But I'm watching this guy and I'm like thinking, man, this dude is really pulling this gimmick off, man. It's scary as hell. Kids, they showed the audience, the crowd shot, and these kids about to shit their pants. That's how scary it was. So anyway, fast forward.
Let me just jump in real quick. When I was a kid, when you go to the matches, you go running up and you, hey, screw you to the wrestlers. And then they make a move at you. And you're like, you're not going to do anything. I'll sue you. Right. Abdul the Butcher, you start yelling at him. He'd walk towards you. I'd back up. You know, I'm like, I'm like in high school. I'm like, I don't know if I can sue him. Like, this guy, I thought he was for real. I thought this guy was the madman from the Sudan. I thought he was real. I found out he's just a fat guy from Canada. I was brokenhearted.
But with due respect.
With all respect. Abby. No, I don't mean, no, he's amazing. But he was terrifying. I mean, I really thought he was real.
Yeah.
I thought he was real. And when I found out he wasn't from the Sudan, I was really disappointed for a shoot.
Yeah, but also in that protected environment, would he be a dude that might cut you?
Yeah.
So as that high school kid or whatever you were walking up to him, as he's walking back to you, you're going to backpedal.
Yeah.
So anyway, back to the Jake the Snake again.
Yeah.
So Taker's lit up. All of a sudden, they're doing that angle. Paul Bearer's there. God rest his soul. They trap, Jake traps Taker's hand between the coffin. You remember this angle?
Right.
Then
right.
Hits him with a DDT. And this is not on a stage set, right? And he goes, oh, short ride, bad landing.
Greatest.
One of the best angles I've ever seen in my life. It was great.
Greatest catchphrase ever that he didn't. It's the one, he should have used it so much more, but he used it sparingly. But I totally pilfered that and used it in many a promo. Short trip, bad landing. That's why I took the DDT as a finish, because of him.
Really?
Yeah, totally.
Guy, what happened to the once-coveted lethal DDT?
Just jobbed out because people want to use it for high spots. And you know what? People don't do it right, though. There's no for the most part, people don't have any impact because they don't understand the mechanics of the body. You know, it's almost like your feet have to go up at a 90-degree angle, which makes you look like you're falling, like you're bumping with so much more speed. And so it's not the height, it's the speed. But what was I going to say? And that's why I sit in the corner. I got that whole idea because Jake would slither into the corner. And I was like, man, I'm taking that and making it my own. So, in fact, somebody tweeted me today. They go, why do you sit in the corner? Well, if you're paying attention to Austin's podcast, now you know. And if you didn't, who cares?
The DDT was something that, man, I probably only used a couple times in my whole wrestling career just because I wasn't really comfortable giving it.
Right.
It looked cool. And it was badass, but I was one of the guys, if I used it, the impact wasn't there.
Well, part of the reason, too, is, and I had to tell guys all the time, is don't do a somersault. Guys would do a somersault for the bump, and there's no impact then. It's a somersault, you know, so you have to go take a flat face bump. That makes it, or if you're a canyoner, and Canyon and Kidman could take it and spike and just be spiked into the ground and stay there like a javelin that just landed.
Yeah.
I don't know how they did it, but like they just pivot. They just put their hand down and their arm and just, I guess it's stomach muscles, and just hold their body like they just got shot into the ground and stay there for like 3 seconds before just collapsing.
Is that your favorite finish of all time?
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I did it. And why can't Vince McMahon take a stunner properly?
Man, every time I gave that guy a stunner, that first time I lit him up in Madison Square Garden, you know, I got the plan. We were going to go out there. We executed it. And all of a sudden, man, I kick him in the gut. And, you know, Vince, man, he's a real muscular, bound-up guy. So he kind of bends over a little bit, and I try to grab him. I got to make a mid-air adjustment. Almost lost him. Anyway, I was able to finish the stunner. But every time I stun that guy, and I love Vince, and he's tough as nails, and I really like the angle that he just shot an angle with Kevin Owens a couple of weeks ago, and Kevin Owens headbutted him for a shoot. Tough.
Yeah, I heard about that.
And so Vince, I texted Kevin Owens after I said, nice work. I said, the old man's a tough son of a bitch. And he goes, yeah, he is. So anyway, that's what I think about Vince.
I bet Owens really appreciated that.
Oh, yeah. But just anytime I work with Vince, he was the greatest guy in the world to work with because he was out there to get all the showmanship that he could out of
right.
it. And I loved his old commentary, the way he got wrapped up. Some people thought he overdid things. I loved his commentary. But out there when you're doing business with him, he's just not real athletic.
No.
Not athletic at all. Like the one time we were working in the Valentine's Day Massacre in Memphis, Tennessee at the Pyramid, he goes to throw me into the cage. You know, we're outside. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, dude. He whipped me so hard, you know, because most time you gather yourself up so you can take your own
right.
run into
take
the cage and bounce off. But he threw me with such force, I'm like, God damn, I guess I'm going to take a bump over here.
How about when the Dudleys tried to super bomb him and he tipped the whole cart over and they fell off the top rope onto the floor?
He's not the most graceful guy in the world. So I don't know what the stunner abilities. You know, for the most part, I think it was a pretty easy bump to take.
Yeah.
I took it myself. Rock gave it to me a couple times.
Yeah.
I enjoyed taking
Ray,
it.
Scott Hall takes it like $1 million. He just puts his head down, hits your shoulder, and just jumps up. But Vince somehow takes a flat face bump.
But then the deal is the after sale when he goes into like the, mm-hmm. like a seizure.
The convulsions.
Yeah. And he got his eyes are open. This look on his face is priceless.
Yeah.
But anyway, where do you want to go from here?
Wherever you want to go. We can talk about sex, drugs, rock and roll.
Oh, you want to buy me some time here?
I'll buy you some. I'll vamp. I'll vamp for you.
Brian Pillman. I just got it was on Twitter the other day. I guess it's been 20 years since Brian Pillman passed away. And back in the day, in our WCW days, you, me, and Brian used to rent those Chevy Lumina vans, and we called ourselves the Comedy Trio, plagued by bad service.
Plagued by bad service.
In every
totally
Waffle House or
that.
Restaurant we went to.
I forgot that. We were yeah. plagued by bad service.
That was our trademark.
Yes.
And we traveled around the world together, around the United States. Goddamn, we booked the territory. And if you and me were booking a territory, Pelmo was riding shotgun, reading his vocabulary books.
Yes, his power vocabulary books.
Because he's trying to build up, you know.
You always had to drive because Pelmo would be in the back. He'd be laying in the back reading. I always drove like crap so that you would. So you'd like, I'm not letting you drive. And I'm like, good.
Your wheel skills. Worst. Like Diamond Dallas Page. I don't like Dallas' driving. I didn't like Mick Foley's driving. Kevin Nash, I liked his driving skills. Billy Gunn, safe driver. You scared me.
I'm the worst wheel man in the business.
So, but so self-admittedly, so you're cool with it. There's no heat there.
No,
so
I
anyway,
could care
we're
less.
We're driving down the road, laughing and joking and stuff, and booking a territory. And I can't believe it's been 20 years since that guy has died. And I'll never forget. I want to see if you got any Pillman stories. I'll never forget, man, right before he passed away, we was up there, was it Minnie or somewhere, because we were going to have a pay-per-view, and he'd been in the company for 6 months, I can't remember how long it was. He's kind of wobbling a little bit, carrying his suitcase mm-hmm. out of building. I hadn't worked yet. And I said, man, he don't look so good. Because as tight as we were, you know, back in the day, you know, when I got up to WWF, man, I was kind of doing my own thing at that time.
Right.
And here comes Brian. He was recovering from my ankle.
Because you were wrestling Savio Vega in his Sears tough skin pants.
Yeah. No, dude, Savio could work his ass off.
Yeah.
Man, that's a working son of a bitch. But, you know, I saw Brian, and then, you know, he ended up passing away. But I was just like, never in a million years that I think that guy would meet his demise that early, because, dude, I just figured, first of all, he was a man's man. He was tough as nails. Everybody liked him. I mean, he was
everybody
some of the guys
liked
because,
him.
I mean, he was out there.
Greatest locker room promo history to business.
Yeah, well, him and Arn. And so I just figured, man, there's no way the guy's so smart and just intelligent and electric. There's nothing ever going to happen to that guy. And then all of a sudden, you know, we heard he died, and then we're out there, and they ring the bell 12 times. I don't think it really hit me or understood that Brian was gone until they started ringing that damn bell.
Really?
Tolling the bell, whatever. And then it's like, yeah, that was a heavy moment. It was on Monday Night Raw. It was like, God dang, the gravity of it all weighed in. It
if he weird. Can die, that means any of us can.
Yeah, so, but I'll never forget, man, when I first got the call to come to WCW from USWA, and you know, from the weekly territory days, when you go to WCW, now you're on a guaranteed contract.
Right.
And so you got a paycheck coming in the mail, you know, like in Memphis, you got paid every Wednesday in right. Evansville. And we would go.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And we would go to Evansville to the liquor store and cash our checks. And, you know, sometimes I was just double digits. And that's after working 6 days.
Yeah.
So it was ridiculous. So I
wow, double digits?
Oh, yeah, dude.
Ooh.
And because sometimes we, you know, if the territory was down and we were working 3 to 4 days a week rather than the normal
sure.
six. So anyway, I go into Atlanta. I'm the new guy in the territory. I'm at the Atlanta Gold's Gym at the mm-hmm. airport.
Sure.
And all of a sudden, I see Pillman across the gym. Dude, Pillman's jacked up.
Yeah.
Of course, he had his waist was like 28 inches, broad shoulders, all jacked up. I said, you could kind of feel the electricity from across the gym. I said, oh, damn, there's Flying Brian.
Yeah.
I'd seen him on television, but you know, when you're in the territories or the grass system and the guys are in the big leagues, you just kind of, you see them doing their thing. So I didn't go introduce myself to him, be a marker, something like
right.
that. So anyway, sure enough, I start working. You know, I see him here, there. We pass by. You know, we're always cool with each other, but, you know, we got to be kind of friendly. And I'll never forget, we rolled into Dothan, Alabama, television taping. Here comes Brian, and I know him a little bit. And I don't even think we'd work together yet. And he goes, hey, kid. He goes, we need to come up with a finish. We're a tag team. I said, dude, what the fuck are you talking about? I said, I'm fixing to get a United States title run with Harley Race because that's yeah. what Dusty's plans were for me to do. And I told Brian, I said, no, man, I'm going to be the U.S. champion with Harley Race. He goes, no. He goes, we're a tag team. Go talk to Dusty. So I go find Dusty. I say, Dusty, I was just talking to Brian. I said, what's going on? He goes, yeah, baby. He goes, I'll save the whole
sure.
list. And so anyway, we turned into a tag team. And at first, you know, I think they just put us together to get over established yeah, tag teams.
You know, I think you might be remembering this slightly wrong.
What?
And which I wouldn't, which, look, I'm remembering it wrong, but I remember that we were riding together, the three of us already, and then me and Pillman wanted to be a tag team, and you were going to get the U.S. title, and then Pillman found
right.
out. Yeah.
Okay, so, but I am right because I did want to be I was going to be the U.S.
Right,
champion.
Right, yeah,
you
right.
guys want to be tag team.
You guys were already, for good
okay,
friends.
Okay, so
by then.
We were all riding together. Thank you
yeah.
for clearing that up.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, and it's like I always felt like I got to be the odd man out, but it wasn't that. Watts just didn't like me, so I wasn't going to be there much longer. But
that was right. You guys wanted to be a tag team.
Yeah, because we figured we're both smaller, you know, that, fuck, you know, that way we can, you know, because. If you're smaller, you got to be in a tag team, you know. I mean, what I never understood was with all the drugs Brian did and drinking, why he didn't just gas up and become 220, 230, 240 and just, you know, because he always felt like that he was, you know, that it was this, which it was his size holding him back because, you know, the big man mentality.
Dude, I always heard his football accolades, you know, throughout my wrestling career. I heard, hey, man, that guy's a badass football player, all this stuff. And I think, okay, mm-hmm. I guess he was. And I just knew him as a badass pro wrestler.
Right.
And then we shot the angle where I was going to break into his house with a gun.
Right.
His wife was there and all that. And all of a sudden, I get there, and we're kind of just going through the beats, what we're going to do. And this is pretty cutting edge for 1995.
Oh, really?
There was.
It was too soon. It was.
Oh, yeah.
If you'd have done it 4 years later, I'd have been main event money drawing, nothing but business.
Well, it was attention getting for sure.
Yeah.
So anyway, but... There we were at his house in Cincinnati, or right, actually in Kentucky on the border. And, dude, I walked in his basement. He had a real nice house. And, dude, there was All-America awards plastered all over the damn basement. And I was like, he had his own tanning bed, the whole setup, and everything was framed real nice. I was like, holy shit, man. You know, the rumors of this guy being a football star weren't bullshit.
Right, right.
He was the real deal.
Yeah. Although, I have to say one thing, though, not about him, but – I always hated when they'd go, oh, this guy played pro football. And then they'd be like, I'm like, wait a minute. If the guy played pro ball and he didn't become a big star, but he comes to wrestling, he's a big star. That means we're less than the football players. Why wouldn't they ever say he quit football to be a wrestler as opposed to using the fact that he played football as an accolade? You know what I mean?
Right.
That always irritated me.
Sometimes when I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking about Lance Russell and storytelling.
come on, Eddie. Tommy Rich waylaid by Eddie Gilbert. Oh, boy, howdy.
Because a lot of times we were riding down the road, you'd go into that or you'd go into your...
Gordon Solie. Yep. Brother. The Crimson Mask. My best Gordon Solie, my favorite thing he ever did was he was so, he always maintained his cool, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was always professional. And one time Oliver Humperdinck got so mad at him, he started choking Gordon Solie. And Gordon Solie's going, "Regain your composure, sir. Regain your composure." That's awesome.
I never
He didn't fight back. He didn't try to get the hands off his neck. He just went, "Regain your composure, sir."
I never did know this about him. About Gordon, that he liked to drink a lot of vodka while he was working.
Yeah.
Were you down in Florida?
Yeah, yeah.
How did you get to know him?
It was one of the biggest thrills of my career was to commentate with him. You know, because I grew up watching him, and so I got to do color commentary with him. And he would always have, what I loved about it was he was so classy. He had a drink and a smoke, but in the same hand. Yeah. So he has, you know, the drink he's holding with his hand, but the two big fingers are off to a little bit off the glass with a cigarette in his hand, and he'd smoke, take a smoke off of the thing, and then he'd take a sip of the drink, and I was like, oh, it's just so cool. And he had those Cuban shirts he always wore, but he had a cough button, and when he had, when he hit that thing, you know, from all the years of smoking. But man, what a class act he was. Oh, he was amazing.
What did you learn anything from him as far as prep goes? Because I know, because I'm pretty good friends with Jim Ross, and every time I've seen Jim Ross, which rarely, but when he's getting ready to do something, dude, whether it's pay-per-view or television, he's got notes out the ass. He knows everybody's history. Of course, he's obviously involved with a lot of the operational procedures. But that dude does his homework and he's prepared. How was Gordon? Was he like that, or was he just a dude just called it like he saw it?
He didn't need any preparation. He did all his preparation, I guess, at home. But, I mean, he knew – I mean, because he was in the Florida territory for 20 years, so he knew all the history. So he didn't have to prepare, I guess. And I don't know. I mean, I don't think I was privy to that. I wasn't at that level yet. I was just, you know, the kid. I'd only been working 3 months at that point, other than the 7 to 9 matches that I had beforehand.
So if you were just starting in the business or young in the business, how annoying were you to him? Did you get on his nerves, or were you smart enough to stay back?
No, I stayed back. I stayed back. You know, I annoyed the boys, but he was office too. So, you know, I didn't. You know, so, and the commentators always kind of kept off, you know, to the commentators. You know, refs stay with refs. The boys stay with the boys. Enhancement guys stay with enhancement guys. It, you know, it's the class system.
So who's your favorite announcer of all time?
My three favorites are four favorites. Jim Ross, Lance Russell, Gordon Solie, and believe it or not, Joey Styles. Those first 2 years I was in ECW. That was Joey's two finest years. I mean, and he was as good as anybody. I thought Jim Ross, I loved the old Jim Ross when he was with Michael Hayes for the UWF.
Yeah.
That I thought, I mean, this is just my opinion, but I felt like he wasn't as jaded then. Like, you know, maybe so, not that he wasn't amazing, you know, he was amazing from the first time I saw him to the last time I saw him. And he'll always be amazing because he's just that good. But I always felt like, and maybe it was the politics, but looking back, like, when he was working for UWF, he was younger, and I just felt like he wasn't as jaded as he became once he got to WCW or WWE, when the politics game just came in, and just, you know, he had to fight for his life all the time, you know? I mean, and Vince always trying to get rid of him because he was too old, which is so stupid. I mean, age has nothing to do with greatness. So, I don't know. I mean, but as much as I love the old Jim Ross, I also, you know, the later he got, the better he got as well. So, it's two different flavors of the same guy that are both fantastic.
Man, I saw him, you know, because I grew up watching a lot of stuff. I watched NWA. I didn't get WWF yet. And then I hadn't gotten, I didn't get AWA in its prime. I caught on the decline.
You didn't get to watch Rod Trongard?
No, but I got a chance. I was watching Bill Watts' Power Pro Wrestling, where Jim Ross was doing the commentating with Michael PSA's Prissy Sissy.
Right.
I mean, that was a great combination.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And, you know, God dang, Jim was young. He was just full of enthusiasm. He just had a great, Jim was a natural born storyteller. And then when he went to NWA, it was saying, you know, same shit. It was all good stuff. And he came to WWF or WCW and then WWF. I just always loved his commentating. Towards the end, with the cans on, being overproduced,
Right.
I said, man, I can tell he's been overproduced.
Right.
Because, man, when Jim's just doing his shit and just working with whoever he's calling with, then he's awesome. But I thought when they put the cans on him and just started giving him too much in his ears, I think it was just discombobulated. Well,
which I think is why I gravitated to UWF, because he was, I'm sure he had carte blanche, because, I mean, Watts was going to, you know, tell him this and that, but once he was out there, he was, you know, doing his thing, you know, and...
Yeah, but also when you remember stuff, or if I remember stuff from that, I'm remembering it for what it was and how old I was at the time.
Yeah.
So the impressions are much more different. Even if I watch that stuff back today, I realize how good he is.
Yeah.
Or was.
Yeah, I bet if I watched them together, I would say the later Jim Ross was way better. But my memory of him in UWF, because it was such a formative moment for me watching that show, because that, until ECW came along, I thought was the best wrestling show I'd ever seen. I mean, and I grew up on Florida Championship Wrestling, but the UWF, man, it's what Raw became and what ECW became. It was house show TV. You know, the crowd was live at Tulsa. My God, it's all breaking down here in Tulsa. You know, the angles were so tight. You know, even the squash matches, you know, they had, I guess they had some guy, the Libyan, remember? Just the generic Libyan.
I don't remember the Libyan.
Libyan. But they had so many guys that could work, like Wild Bill Irwin. What a worker. Yeah. And then they turn him into the goon, you know, just sad, you know.
But going back to Joey Styles, and because ECW was just lit up on fire there for a little bit, and he was awesome.
And he was doing it by himself.
Yeah.
That's hard. I mean, a one-man team.
Yeah.
You know, same with Lance Russell.
The thing about Lance Russell was he could interview a deaf mute and ask the question and then answer it for him. And he did that with so many guys.
Yeah. And what I loved about Lance Russell was he was rooting for the babyface. He was trying to be partial, but he couldn't quite, like Gordon Sully was always partial. You know, I mean, he was always down the middle, slightly partial, but... Because, you know, there's good versus evil, so he had to be on good side. But Lance Russell, you knew, was like, you know, oh, come on. Oh, come on, Eddie. Oh, you'll get more than what you got right now.
Yeah.
Just he was, and he did it for so long by himself, if I remember, before Dave Brown came along. And just trying to, you know, he knew when to back out, let the action speak for itself. Like, he didn't just have a wall of sound. Same with Joey Styles. Like, he knew when to pull back, let the action speak, jump back in. And but, you know, Joey also had Paulie producing him. So that's another, you know, that definitely helped him. Not that Joey didn't do it, you know, the legwork, but he also had Paulie in his ear.
All right, I'm taking a quick pause for the calls here with Raven Scott Levy, my buddy, my old travel partner, host of the Raven Effect podcast on the Jericho Network at Podcast One. And I'm going to give some big ups to a sponsor who makes this podcast possible, and that's TrueCar. Now, there's something about TrueCar a lot of people don't know, that TrueCar can also help you find a used car. In fact, there are over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. Now, whether you're looking to buy new or used, TrueCar gets you upfront pricing information that empowers letting you see what other people pay for the car you want so you can know what a fair price is and feel confident. And with TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing to make the process quick and easy. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
What's happening, guys? This is Chael Sonnen, America's favorite gangster. Make sure you check out my show, You're Welcome, right here at Podcast One. I've got guests like Stone Cold Steve Austin, Dana White, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and upcoming Brad Pitt and Will Smith are going to be in studio to talk about upcoming projects. Go, listen, enjoy, check it out. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Send a pigeon, send a fax, write it on a postage stamp. Just make sure you are listening to Your Welcome at Podcast One, or download and listen on the Podcast One app.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
So what did you think when you first ended up down at ECW? Because that was a little bit different than anything that was going on at the time.
I had seen the show on TV,
And so, and when, as soon as the first time I saw an episode, like when I left WWE and I was supposed to go to Smoky Mountain and Cornette kept saying he was going to bring me in and kept pushing it back a month, another month, another month. Thank God he did. Cause, in the meantime, I was living in Philly, which is where the indie hub is, so I could get more bookings. And all I heard was ECW was garbage. So I didn't think about even going, but then I watched an episode. And it was the greatest TV show I'd ever seen. It reminded me of UWF. And I was like, I got to be on this show. And then I called DDP up and I said, you're good friends with Paulie. Get me on the show. So he called Paulie. And then Paulie says, all right, I'll do it. I'll bring him in. And so DDP, so I'd been out all night the night before. And I got home like, you know, two in the afternoon. I was all coked up the night before. All of a sudden, my roommate wakes me up. He's like, DDP's on the phone. He says, you got to talk to him now. I'm like, so I wake out of my stupor. And I'm like, what? He goes, Paulie's going to call you in like 5 minutes. I'm like, all right. So the phone, now I'm trying to stay awake for like 5 minutes. The phone rings. I pick it up. Paulie goes, I'll call you right back. He calls back a few minutes later. I'm still trying to fight the stupor. Tells me when I'm starting the whole nine yards. I'm like, thanks, man. So I'm like, yeah, that's great. DDP calls. I call DDP. I'm like, yeah, I got the job. He's like, when do you start? I go, I have no idea. Totally spaced the whole phone call. So then I was like, man, I don't know when my starting date is. So I wait. I watched on the show that like the next town, next time they were in that area was whatever, like next Friday or something. So I was like, I'll show up. I know it's not when I start, but I'll show up and just kind of weasel my way and try and schmooze my way to find out when I am supposed to start. So I I'm driving to the town, but nobody knows where the show is. I don't know the name of the building. I know it's at a high school, and I know it was a high school named after somebody famous, like an astronaut or somebody, but I couldn't remember the name. And so I'm like, crap. So I go, I go into like a 7-Eleven. I go, is there a high school around here with like an astronaut name? And they're like, yeah, it's over there. So I go to there, wrong school. must not be an astronaut. Must be like a president. So I went to another school. Nope, not that. How many schools are there named after famous people? I go to a third school. I'm like, oh, that's it. But now it's getting late and the show's getting ready to end. And I'm like, crap. Or at least I think it's getting ready to end because it's getting late. I'm like, oh, I got to get in there. So I come in there and I just kind of mosey my way into the locker room. And Paulie's like, what are you doing here? You don't start for a couple of weeks. I was like, oh, I know that. I just wanted to come by and say hi. When do I start?
So had you created the Raven gimmick yet?
Yeah. I created that. And then I created the character, but I knew I needed a TV show to do it on. And so that's why I wanted to go to Smoky Mountain, because I figured if I can do it on their show, I'll get over and then I can hopefully go back to New York. And so when DDP explained the character to Paulie, he thought it was going to be like a grunge version or like still thought it was going to be a comedy character. But when he saw it, he realized what I was doing, and he knew the character better than I did at first, because I was still developing it, and I wasn't realizing how much I was taking from me, you know, from my own life, you know, because I was putting the pieces together, but you know, when you look inside, you don't always see what's there, because you don't want to, and luckily, he, you know, promoters always see, or bookers always see the show through a particular town, and like Vince saw himself as the Million Dollar Man, and Lex Luger the Patriot. And Dusty loved PN News, even though he didn't get over, but because he was a rapping big man. And Paulie saw the world through Raven's eyes and Dreamer's eyes. And so it just enabled me to work with him, you know, no matter how much I annoyed him. It was the most wonderful collaborative experience I ever had. I mean, it really was that much fun.
How would you describe the Raven character to someone who you're about to turn on to ECW wrestling, but you got to check out this Raven guy. Okay. Who's he? What does he do?
He's a tortured poetic genius who blames everybody else for his problems and refuses to look inward and blame. Yeah. Pretty much that's simple enough. I mean, you know, that's pretty much it.
And when you think about it, when you look back at that locker room, dude, there were some lights out promos in that territory.
Yeah.
How long did it take for you? You've always had a gift of gab, but channeled through the Raven, you took it to the highest level.
Thank you.
How long did it take you to come up with the shit that you were going to say with respect to setting up a match, talking about your opponent, your situation, or yourself? Just promos in general. What approach did you take?
I'd love to say that I knew from the beginning, but I didn't. like my first promo was like 30 seconds because I still was feeling it out. And, you know, I think I remember it. It's, the world is full of kings and queens. They'll blind your eyes and steal your dreams. It's heaven and hell. Kurt Cobain didn't make it, and he left behind an entire generation of something. Quote the Raven, Nevermore. Because I already had the catchphrase when I came up with the name. And so that was like the best I could pull off at that point. And then I got, there was a period where I was with Mick Foley, where I was managing him, but he, you know, while I was wrestling. And Mick probably cut the single best promos of his career and maybe in the business, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about Uncle Eric, and Uncle Eric didn't love him. And of course, then I would just go, quote the Raven, Nevermore. That's all, you know, and steal the heat. Yeah. So I always aspired to do a promo of that level. And I finally nailed one. And it was in some building, I forget where, I think in Boston. But yeah, so I mean, it took a while to really hit the nail on the head. Like, I feel like I had more in the tank because I didn't get the run in New York. People say, what's your favorite match? I go, or what's your best match? I'm like, I don't think I had it. I don't think I ever got to have it. But of what I did have, there's about five that I really stand out. But the promo wise, there was just one promo, it was like 8 minutes or something. And I remember when I cut it, I nailed it. And I remember Shea Douglas afterwards, he'd already cut a promo earlier. He's like, Paulie, I got to go again. And I'm like, bastard. And so Shane pulled out, I remember this, he pulled out I can't remember the promo I cut, but I remember I quoted Billy Corgan in it, from 1979, but Shane pulled out every trick. He's like, he opens a promo, throws a chair against the wall. He goes, they won't let the franchise talk about this, but I'm going to tell you anyway. And I was like, you could try, but this, you're not going to step on my finest hour.
And Shane would drop some badass promos.
Yeah, oh, he could talk.
Yeah, and so was, and Mick was too.
Yeah, Mick was just, he was in a zone there for like, when he turned heel, it was just the story he told. I mean, And that's, to me, that's the greatest heel, is the guy who has a point of view that's either just a little skewed or he's right about everything, but he just takes it too far, you know, and just abuses the fact that he has that point of view.
What did you do before you went out on those ECW shows, just as far
pills.
As getting ready? Straight up.
Yeah, I mean.
Were you that fucked up?
No, I just, you know, like the. Painkillers became like an army, like an armor for me. You know, it felt like a shield of armor. You know, it puts you in no pain, and that no pain feeling was like a coat of armor for me. And then when I quit doing drugs and I had to wrestle without it for the first year or so, you know, all of a sudden I had that anxiety again from, you know, that I hadn't had in years other than like for big matches or something. And, because my coat of armor was gone, you know? So, but where I really screwed up was when I started, like, you know, because I drink after the shows. I never drank before a show. I prided myself on never doing that. And once I took that first beer before a show, that was the beginning of the slow descent into madness.
What happened?
No. I mean, that's just that's when my drinking, and that led to my drinking and drugging becoming so heavy that eventually I got a pancreatitis and I had to stop drinking, which led to my drugging becoming so much worse. But if I never would have started drinking before the show, I never would have became an alcoholic and never would have drank. Because drinking every night's one thing, but drinking all day and all night's a whole other matter.
God dang, dude, when we were riding down the road, you, me, and Brian, I don't even remember you drinking.
No, I mean, I didn't drink much. I didn't take a lot of pills. I didn't take any pills. I mean, it just, you know, I don't know. You know, I found a way to deal with all my emotional issues by pouring a drink on them and pouring pills in there. And so I didn't have to deal with it, you know.
So when did you quit all that stuff and go back to wrestling with nothing?
Before I went to WWE. Before I went to WWE, I got clean and sober. And I stayed clean and sober for a long time. I went off, you know, I had a few runs off, you know, afterwards, you know, with pills. But, you know, for the most part, it was back in 99, 2000. I don't know. Whenever I went to WWE as Raven, that was when I quit.
you know, and then I quit everything. You know, I mean, everything, probably at least 7-8 years ago. I don't, maybe 10 years. It could be longer. I mean, I don't know. It's, I never put a date on it. I never went to AA, and not that that's not a good thing, but to me, that was just like listening to people brag. I'd want to tell, like, if I went to a meeting, I would just want to tell, I got a better story than that. You know, it would have been a competition for me. So that wasn't the way for me. It was just a matter of, although on the other hand, playing, you know, devil's advocate, I saw an addictionologist, you know, who's a psychiatrist who specializes in addiction medicine. And he said, you know, you may not actually be an addict. You just, he goes, but I've never seen anybody abuse drugs more than you.
Well, dude, when I was drinking, I would just drink to pass time because I was right. bored. I just wanted something to do.
Right.
And I could kill a lot of hours drinking a lot of whiskey or vodka or whatever.
Life's long.
Yeah. But I mean, and it's easy to do
yeah.
because it's a pleasurable experience. I don't drink as much anymore. But I just got finished talking to a guy a couple of weeks ago. He came on the show. He was a heavy duty drug guy and just a raging alcoholic. And then he knew, he came to one day, just had this that come to Jesus meeting
right, right.
that moment. And it was like, dude, I'm going to die. If you don't stop today, you're going to die. And so he cleaned up from there on out.
Sure.
He turned into an ultra racer. Started off, I mean, just running on a treadmill. He could run about 15 seconds at a time. He went from 320 down to whatever, 180 over the course of the time. And he started running, you know, marathons. And running
ultra marathons?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
100-mile races.
That's ridiculous.
So, but he would, it was almost like, you know, he just needed something to do positive. So what did you do or what was your approach to putting all that shit away?
Well, first of all, I did so much ecstasy. I fried my brain cells to the point where I literally, like, if, you know, we've been talking for 2 hours. I wouldn't remember what I did before I came to your house. That's how bad the problem, that my brain got addled. And, but luckily, you know, I had like this alternative healer, this chiropractor who knew like every form of alternative healing and kind of put me back together, you know, with all these esoteric, you know, techniques. And he put my brain back together. And then it was a matter of, well, never doing drugs again, never doing ecstasy again. I already wrote coke off a long time before that. You know, I already wrote booze off because I got pancreatitis. That was the most painful thing I've ever lived through. It was 8 day. I got pancreatitis. I was supposed to be at TV. I was supposed to fly out for TV, and my stomach, well, like, you know, the pancreas, like it's above your stomach, like where the solar plexus is. It started hurting so bad. And my buddy who's was going to med school, he's like, you got pancreatitis. We're going to the hospital. They put me in a bed. They said, do you do drugs? And so, of course, I thought if I told them yes, they wouldn't give me any. So I said no. So they never gave me enough meds to stop the pain because my level of tolerance was so high. So I was howling at nights. And you can't eat any food until your pancreas clears. So no food, no water, no nothing for like 8 days. And the first 4 days, I mean, I was literally howling in pain at night. They would just close my door and just, you know, I'd just have to suffer. And so I never was going to drink again. So that was done. You know, the ecstasy, that was done. The coke was already done before. The injectable drugs, I broke that off, you know, and that's when I knew I was coming to the end of the line. And then it was just a matter of, I'm not going back to any of those things. So, you know, I already checked them off the list. There's nowhere to go anyway. So then I became a shopping addict, started wasting money left and right because, you know, you got to transfer the addiction until you deal with it. And then I started seeing a psychologist and dealt with it and, you know, figured out what my problems was, my baggage was, you know, and, you know, I still got problems and I still got baggage, but now I can deal with it, you know, in a healthy manner as opposed to, you know, a stupid manner.
I mean, like, well, how do you deal with it? I mean, like, is there a trigger that will set you off and like, hey, man.
Like I get
check myself.
Like all right, so like I get anxiety when I gotta make phone calls. Like I hate making phone calls to people. Like when you called earlier this morning, I'm like all right. So I pick up the phone and I'm like, and so in my head I'm going, I don't want to be on the phone too long. Don't want to be on too short. I don't want to, you know, yeah. And you start thinking, you're like, you know, because you know you don't want to aggravate your buddy. You know what I mean, but. So you don't want to drag the call, but you don't want to cut him off too soon while he's still happy to be on the phone. And I'm like, so, but those kind of things make me nutty. And so now I just go, all right, well, either deal with it, you know, and just take a deep breath, deal with it and just play it by ear like you do the rest of life, or, you know, or
suffer. So, you know, you talk to yourself, you know.
So you try to stay off the phone?
Yeah, so I stay off the phone, basically. No, that's just a small example, you know what I mean? So, you know, but then you have friends you can talk to that you just talk to, and it's like, you know, it's no big deal. But then when you haven't talked to somebody in a while, but that's just an example. I mean, I like doing stand-up. You know, when I first started doing stand-up comedy, like, I didn't think it was going to be anything. I thought, you know, I'm not going to be nervous at all. I wasn't nervous. Got on stage. My knees started shaking. Like, you know, your leg shakes. Yeah. My leg shook so hard for the entire 45 minutes of my first stand-up gig. But, you know, it's either you deal with it or you don't deal with it. You know, so you talk to yourself. You're like, just relax. Take a deep breath. You know what I mean? So you get better at teaching yourself positive health reinforcement techniques, you know, and or you just ignore it and stuff it down and let it come out another day.
What is it about, or how has your experience been with doing stand up and hanging around other comedians? Because you always hear the thing, man, it's comedians, some of the most miserable people on earth, but making people laugh gives them joy.
Yeah, it's weird. I haven't had enough. I've done, I don't know. I only do like 8-10 gigs a year, so I don't do that many. So, you know, and I started doing it like in 2011 or 12 or something. But then I had the shoulder surgery, which my mom passed away in 2013. And then like a week later, I had shoulder surgery. And my shoulders were so bad that I went to the Atlanta Braves, the head of the orthopedic surgeon for the Atlanta Braves. He said I had the two worst shoulders he's ever seen. So I was pretty proud of that.
Yeah.
So that took a year out of my life, over a year to rehab it, you know, and it still did. I mean, you can see, I can't hardly rotate. I can't hardly lift it, but it's out of pain. So, you know, so it was successful, but it took over a year. And then I was happy for the first time just doing nothing. You know, I wasn't working out. I wasn't doing nothing. I was watching TV and I was like, I like this. You know, I play with my dog, you know, my ex-wife's my best friend. So we see each other every day. And I was like, man, I like this. So 6 months go by after the year, still did nothing. And then finally I said, it's probably time to start making a little money, you know, but I'm pretty financially set. So, you know, so I'm very lucky about that. So then I was like, well, but I should still have income coming in. And so then I gradually started, you know, doing indie bookings again after like a, you know, a year and a half off. And, but still being a sloth and lazy, I still, you know, don't, you know, I'll go 3 months where I work like, you know, 8-10 shows, and then I'll go 3 months and not work a single show. And but I find if I'm home too long without going on the road, that I get antsy and I start getting, you know, I start feeling insecure, because you have nothing to make yourself feel good about, because you're not doing anything, so watching TV. So then I go back on the road, I feel better about myself, you know, make some money, come home. And so I gradually started to do stand-up again. I didn't even start doing that again until this year. So I did a couple, like 3, 4, 5 gigs in Indiana. Did some gigs somewhere else. Then some guy just texted me or called me or emailed me or whatever to book me for some more stand-up gigs. So I'm really just trying to enjoy life. You know, I don't hurt. Other than the sleep disorder, I feel great. I'm happy. I like my life. Love my ex-wife, love my dog, I love watching TV, because that, like you say, you know, you get bored, so you're drinking to kill the time. You know, there's so much good TV, and to me, you know, that's why I loved wrestling, because it was the ultimate morality play. It was good versus evil, you know, which is what any good story's about, and it was like opera for the masses. But now I, you know, I don't have the same enjoyment, but I found that enjoyment I found in watching wrestling, you know, and watching so many other shows like The Blacklist, or, you know, there's so much good TV now.
Yeah, but hanging around, if you're doing a comedy clubs, I mean, you're not working them steady, but are they like the boys? Do they take you in?
Same thing. It's the exact same, except you don't have to lace up your boots.
Right.
Which is a pain in the ass. You know, remember, like, you'd be like, oh, I don't feel like lacing my boots up.
You're still in the ring?
Yeah, I got a tag match next week in Montreal, I think.
You're a healer, baby, and are you making a comeback?
This is my psychology. I don't want to take any bumps anymore. I refuse to take any bumps because I don't feel like getting beat up anymore. So as a babyface, come in on the shine, let my partner take the heat, And then I'll get the hot tag, no bumps, no fluff, no muss, no, you know. And then I, but it, the fans aren't going to notice because they're not there to see me get beat up. They're there to see me make a comeback. And they, I got a partner, you know, whoever the tag team partner is to get beat up. So, and that's the great thing about wrestling is you can hide anything. You don't like guys are always like, you know, guys are like, ah, you know, I'm injured. I can't work. You know, yeah, you work around it. You know, like when me and Pillman first started feuding, he hurt his quad. And he was really worried because he wasn't going to be able to do all the high flying. And, you know, this was his first feud with somebody who it wasn't going to be just, you know, match versus match, you know, high flying match like with Liger or something. It was actually hopefully going to be a storyline. And I'm like, man, you don't need to, you know, because he had never worked, you know, like Memphis style, you know. And so remember, he used to love this spot I showed him where you go to shake hands, but the guy won't do it. The baby face goes, wait a minute, and puts his left hand out, and then you shake left-handed so you can hip toss him with the right. Yeah, and so
garbage.
Yeah,
I use that spot so many times.
But that's the whole thing.
Bullshit. Yeah.
But that's the thing is people come to be emotionally moved.
Right.
And so, you know, if you tell your story right and you have your psychology, there's no need to take a million bumps. Finley never leaves his feet.
Yeah.
Has amazing matches. And I used to come back from the locker room and I'd have taken two bumps at the most, you know. And he'd go, you took too many. And he was serious, you know. You know that.
So how's it work out there where the places you're going at?
They're just the usual. Oh, that's right. You never done indies, have you?
No.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I mean, you get there. You know, there's always somebody to pick you up, so you don't have to go get a rental car, which is fun. You know, you go to sleep in a ride to the building. You know, you get to the building. You know, you're basically to rule the roost because you're the name. You know, everybody, you can do anything. It's like working with guys where you can say, look, this is what I want to do. You know, and they're like, well, I want to get this and I want to get that. And I'm like, just trust me. And then after the match, they'll go, man, that was the most reaction I ever got. But we didn't even do anything. I'm like, yeah, because that's what wrestling is.
Yeah.
You know, it's Shakespeare, you know?
So how you would laugh on the road without anything, like if I was going on the road, well, I'm not going to go on the road. But even if I travel, dude, I'm good just because I'm good with myself.
Right.
But if you're like you were, I mean, right. Is there any impending?
No. I just... You know, I mean, sometimes I'll be like, man, I wouldn't mind going out. But then I'm like, what am I going to do for if I go out? I don't care about picking up chicks anymore. I've sowed my oats. I've sowed more oats than I can count. I've done everything I've ever going to. I really don't even want to go out. It's just then you start thinking, well, I'm going to be bored in a hotel room. But I just read a lot, you know, or I watch, like I said, I watch TV.
What are you reading?
I haven't started it yet, but I just bought Norm MacDonald's new book. And I was reading this book. What I'm reading mainly, I haven't finished yet, is this book on crop circles. It's really cool. And apparently,
I'm wondering how they make the damn things.
Yeah, I haven't got that far yet. But it's not. There's people that make the fake ones, and then there actually are real ones. And there's like all these differences in between, and like that when you see the photographs, like the photographs of the real ones compared to the fake ones, you're like, holy crap! I mean, it really is different, you know. I saw a UFO one time. I was walking my dog. It's a shoot, you know, like I believe in that stuff, but I was walking my dog and I saw this star up in the sky. I thought it was a plane at first, but it wasn't moving. So I'm like, you know, and it was really bright and it didn't seem like it was that far away. And then there was these three bright lights near it, but much smaller. And so I'm looking at this thing and I'm waiting for it to see if it moves or not. And then all of a sudden one of the smaller ones just starts moving. And then stopped again. I was like, holy shit, that's got to be a UFO because nothing just stays in space and then moves and then stops again. Because it couldn't have been a helicopter because it was way too far away for that. But, you know, I mean, you believe what you believe, you know.
All right, you believe what you believe. You said on your podcast, The Raven Effect, on mm-hmm. Podcast One on the Jericho Network, you always like to talk about conspiracy theories.
I don't believe in this at all, flat earth. We had this flat earth guy on, and he was like,
serious?
He believes it 100%. Like, I've emailed him afterwards, you know what I mean? And tried to give him, well, what about this theory? He's like, nope, that doesn't prove it because this, and this. And he absolutely believes 100% that the earth is flat.
What about, did man go to the moon?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. I was watching enough stuff on that, like that guy, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah.
He goes, it would have been harder to fake going to the moon than to actually go, because to do what they needed to do, it just would have been so much more difficult. But it is amazing, though, that now you could use – we have more power technology in our phones, in our iPhones, than what they had to get to the moon, like with all the computing power.
Right.
It's crazy.
So who's next on your podcast?
I try not to have too many guests. I don't like to bog it down with guests, because me.
So what's the next subject matter?
I don't know. Whatever we get there, we just shoot the shit. You know, me and Busby, we've been best friends for like 15 years, and so, but we drifted apart, like, you know, because he moved to the West Coast because he's a screenwriter, and then we got back, and then we started talking again, and then I had him co-host a show with me, and it's so. We don't even really talk during the week. We just, anything we have to say to each other, we wait till you get on the podcast, and then we just talk for an hour, 10 minutes. And then we're both exhausted and we're like, and then the show, you know, but it's, yeah, we just, you know, we talk about everything from wrestling to the flat earth guy, to what movie we saw or what, you know, UFC, you know. We were talking about, like, the other day, we were talking about Daniel Cormier. This has got to be a nightmare for him. You know, he fights Jones. He can't beat him. He gets beat clean. And then he finds out Jones is all sauced up. And he's like,
the belt back.
Yeah. He's like, how do you think, you know, Cormier's so prideful? It's like, how's his brain has to be doing cartwheels, you know?
He's one of my favorite fighters. But yeah. A lot of people like to boo the guy. I don't understand it. Why is he the heel?
Yeah. It was like Bret Hart. You know, when Bret Hart was the babyface, but the people booed him and cheered Sean instead.
How did you approach Chris, or did Chris approach you to do the Raven Effect?
I had talked to Chris before once his podcast got big, and suggested doing a podcast with him, but he didn't really have the time. And then eventually he decided to start his own network, and so he called me up and said, you know, I'm going to start with Conan, and then I'm going to give you a show. But then in the meantime, he wanted to go with Team Tiger Awesome, so he got them. So a couple more months go by, and I'm thinking, oh, this is a rib. And then he gave Lance Storm and Don Callis, you know, long-time running buddies a show, and I'm like, all right, that makes sense, but is this a rib? You know, because three more months go by. Then he wanted to have another variety, so he had these conspiracy guys on, and I'm like, okay, this is a rib now. And then finally he's like, all right, now we're going to start your show, and I'm like, all right, sweet. You know, he's been great to work for.
Are you? How many shows have you done now?
I don't know. We've been doing it since February, so maybe 6 months worth. 20.
You enjoy it?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, you know, let's face it, I love listening to myself talk anyway.
Well, tell everybody where they can find the show.
You can find the show on Podcast One or Apple Podcast. The show's called The Raven Effect. It comes drops every Monday. What else? Even if you don't like it, just leave a 5-star review anyway. And you could say it sucks, but leave 5 stars and then we'll call it even. We'll call it Squaresville.
You on social media?
Yeah, at The Raven Effect. And basically everything's at The Raven Effect. Facebook's at The Raven Effect. Twitter's at The Raven Effect. That's where I really screwed up, because I always thought social media, I was like, I don't need to have social media. There's nothing I had no reason to engage it. And so all of a sudden, so for my level of celebrity, I only have like 60,000, you know, followers, which, you know, Dreamer's got 2.5 million or something. So I figure I should be at least somewhere between the two of them. And so, but because I never engaged on social media, but that's where your audience comes from for a podcast. So I'm like, I'm doing really well considering the race that, you know, the amount of followers I have compared to downloads, but. You know, I really got to find a way, like by doing your show. I did Corolla's show the other day to get my name out, you know, and to get my, you know, so people can see. This is how I am in real life. You know me. And yeah. So what you see is what you get. Same thing on the podcast. Although it's everything is emphasized towards being funny, towards comedy. I try to make everything, you know, the making people laugh, I think, is the most important thing, you know, or at least entertained. And so... You know, so hopefully people will go, yeah, you know what? I like listening to this schmuck. You know, he's a pretty funny guy, and tune into the show.
Can you send us an out?
Yes, I can.
Scott Levy of the Raven Effect signing off. I'm Steve Austin. I'm coming back to wrap up his show. We're out.
Hello, Dick Enberg here, and I'm mighty excited to announce the start of my new show, Sound of Success, right here on Podcast One. For 60 years, I've rubbed shoulders with sports greatness, from athletes in the world of football, baseball, college and professional basketball, golf, tennis, the Olympics, and so much more. Join me as I explore in-depth stories from the greatest figures in the world of sport, and I'll share a few of my own. Download new episodes of Sound of Success every Thursday on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, and PodcastOne.com. Oh, my.
All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. Before I do that, I want to thank my guest, the Raven, Scott Levy, host of his own podcast called The Raven Effect. Him and his buddy shooting the breeze, talking shit, all kinds of crazy shit. And, of course, you've got the crazy, awesome, wonderful special effects created by Scott Levy himself. Dude's a sharp cat, fucking out there, and he's a good friend of mine. Check out his podcast. It was good seeing you in person, dude. Hey, man, here's something for you guys to watch. Right now, I'm in the middle of watching the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view. I'm not through the pay-per-view all the way yet. Maybe I'll have a few comments about it. I haven't seen the event yet. So far, so good on what I've seen. And then if you ain't seen my show, which is on CMT right now, I highly suggest you set your recording device on your channel box. Someone sent me a tweet the other day that no one uses a DVR anymore. Well, that's what the fuck I call it. I call it a DVR. It's on the fucking DirecTV. That's what the fuck we get. Yeah, man, I just hit the record button. So if it ain't a DVR, I don't know what the fuck it's called. But anyway, check it out. This season, it's building right now. We're three episodes in. We've got the women coming up next week. And things are fixing to start ramping up. I'm telling you, set your DVR or your recording device, whatever the hell you use, for Steve Austin's Broken Skull Challenge on CMT. It's on Tuesday nights, 10, 9 Central, all across the United States of America. If you've never seen this show, give it an opportunity. Just set your DVR and record an episode. If you don't like it, then turn it off after that. But I guarantee you, this is the baddest, toughest, coolest show on television. And that's the bottom line, because I said so. That's something to watch. And as far as all those badass T-shirts I'm wearing on Broken Skull Challenge, you can find those at prowrestlingtees.com/Steve Austin. And if you're thirsty after watching that badass show, I got a good beer for you. It's called Steve Austin's Broken Skull IPA, brewed by El Segundo Brewing Company. Stop by the brewery if you come down here to Los Angeles and you're visiting on a trip. Go by the brewery at 140 Main Street, or go to Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in California. That's where you can find my beer. If you don't live in Cali, check out InsideTheCellar.com and see if they ship to a state that you're living in. Hey, man, if you're looking to get either the Cold Steel Broken Skull knife or the new Working Man knife, you can find them at my new Amazon store. Amazon has the best price on both knives, both extremely high-quality knives, and they're badass. Everybody needs a pocket knife, whether it's to open a letter, cut a piece of rope, a seat belt, save your life, whatever. Just go to Amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. Everybody got to have a pocket knife. I got to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. You can find all my sponsors at PodcastOne.com. Just click on the Killer Deals button at the top of the page and then click on the Steve Austin Show banner. Folks, if you want to follow me on social media, I am on Twitter and Instagram at SteveAustinBSR. And I want to share more stories like the one I read at the open of the show. If you have any stories that you want to share with me, if you have any more questions, comments, or want me to cover a subject that you want to hear about, I want to start doing that more with the direction I'm taking in the podcast. So send all of your questions, comments, suggestions, whatever, to questions@SteveAustinShow.com. You send it in, I'll research it and give you my 411 on it. Folks, until next time, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at PodcastOne.com. That's PodcastOne.com.